out the door, pocket poor, everything I believe in, leaving the score.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to You, Me, Them, Everybody. My name is Brandon Weatherby, and sitting in my tiny West Town apartment is Nick Freed.
Hey, how's it going?
There you go. I met Nick at a Monday night event at the Hungry Brain, and Nick was supposed to come on the podcast in early October, and then this room that you're sitting in got broken into, and then he was supposed to come on again, and then this room again got broken into. So the moral of the story, Nick, is don't live in a bar building my landlord owns.
Done.
Anyways.
Done.
Nick is not just here because he showed up at the Brain, because lots of people show up at the Brain, thankfully, but Nick is a very interesting man. He is the general, he is what you think of when you think of artist. And I say that in a positive way. I don't mean that he doesn't look like a cokehead.
Not yet.
You don't look scraggly. You look put together. It's a good thing. And it's also weird because you're a relatively positive man, and you're in theater.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to come by when it comes to... I've had many conversations with actor friends of mine that are very downtrodden when it comes to doing theater and other things, because it's not the easiest world to be thrown into.
Well, what did you go to school for?
I actually went through a couple of majors and ended with a double major in English and theater.
Okay, so I was also an English major, and that's why I do things like this and bartend.
Right, exactly.
And you're a theater major, and that's why you do things like theater and not much else. No offense.
Yes. No, that's why I do things like theater and unemployment.
There you go. Okay, so why theater? Why did you want to do a theater major? Why did you want to be a theater major?
It sort of started in high school. My oldest brother, both my brothers were involved in theater in like middle school and things like that. And then my oldest brother is the only one who kind of continued it when he hit high school. And I saw him in one show and was like, yeah, that's a lot of fun. I want to do that. And then when I hit high school, that was the first club I joined was Theater Guild. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing shows there. And it was always one of those things where it was like, yeah, this is fun to do. And then my parents in my ear kind of saying, yeah, it's fun, but you got to have a real job. So
your parents are thrilled that you're in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous how supportive they are.
Are you seriously?
Yeah, well, they're incredibly supportive. And like, they very much enjoy coming to see shows and everything. And my mom loves Chicago, so it's just an excuse for her to leave St. Louis and come up here. So it works out very well. So yeah, and then once I hit college, it started kind of settling in that it was sort of a viable path to take when I was doing well in shows and stuff like that. So I was like, yeah, okay, let's try to make this happen.
So you were in high school, you were only acting in plays, correct?
Yes, yeah.
And then in college, what did you do? I know you were a theater major, but what does that entail?
You know, just taking classes, learning all the obnoxious education sides of it, and, you know, all the ridiculous sort of acting theory. And
well, do you think that made you a better actor?
I think a good portion of it did. There's a lot of stuff when it comes to script study and things like that, which helped being an English major as well. And it's mostly just, you know, script study and, you know, learning how to kind of create the character in your head before you actually go into it. But
okay.
There's a lot of acting theory that I don't. A lot of it is just total bunk. And
what is one like common thing that a lot of non-actors think that actors do? Like, do you what is the how should I phrase this? What's the okay, a lot of people think directors are very in their own head and they have an idea of where everything should go. Mm-hmm. And they plan everything out, and that's when you see the people making the square with their fingers and the framing thing. So that's
right.
Like a director stereotype, which is not always true.
Right.
What's the acting what's the theater acting stereotype? That you know is total bunk.
There's surprisingly enough, there's actually a lot of acting stereotypes that aren't bunk at all. And
okay, well, what's one that's actually very good?
I know that there are a lot of theater people who are very in their heads, and a lot of them that are very emotional just in everyday life.
So it really helps if you were molested to be an actor.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's why there's a lot of people that can't turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases that's good. Like, I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis, when he's doing movies and stuff like that, he's never out of character when he's on set. And there's actors, like stage.
So actors. So when he was doing the movie Nine, he was just nonstop fucking. Like that's all he was doing.
Yeah, and you speak in an Italian and just chain smoking all the time. All
right.
Which I mean, you know, he in between him doing
There Will Be Blood.
No, actually, before that, before he did Gangs of New York,
okay.
Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio actually had to go to Italy to convince him to do the movie because he had, whatever movie he did beforehand, Last Mohicans or whatever bullshit, he left America and went and lived in Italy and became a cobbler's apprentice and was learning how to make shoes.
Wait, are you serious?
Yeah, totally serious. Like, it wasn't research for a role, he just was like, I'm going to go to Italy and do this, and... So Martin Scorsese went over there and like talked, sat down with him, and convinced him to do the role. And you know, during that movie, he kept his accent the whole time. And during There Will Be Blood, there's stories where he and Paul Dano never spoke to each other off set. They like the first interaction they had was when they actually spoke to each other on set. I think it was like the first week of shooting. One of the first scenes they did was a scene where he, like, drags Paul Dano through the mud wallows him around in it and stuff. And it's like, he would never speak to him. They wouldn't have conversations. He just kept to himself.
Do you ever see yourself pulling that kind of stuff?
No, because I think that stuff's bullshit.
Okay, that's what I was going to know.
The whole method acting thing that, like, he and Dustin Hoffman and a lot of those people do, it's just like, I mean, it has some merit in it, but it doesn't... I don't know. I feel like it doesn't leave you room to do anything, and it makes you fucking crazy. And,
okay.
I mean, to an extent, Heath Ledger kind of did that with the Joker, and there was reports, interviews that he did where he, like, couldn't shake the character afterwards. And
that's
all
true, but at the same time, Heath Ledger was seen around town consistently skateboarding. You know, it seems convenient to say that, oh, he was always the Joker.
Right.
No, that he just liked heroin a lot. Like, yeah, that's all
that's
is. All,
yeah, it's just a good excuse.
Painkillers are great. And you know what? This brings me to a minor theory I have, and we'll get back to you in just a second.
No, that's fine.
Think about it. Painkillers is the common denominator of human suffering. I don't care how much money you have, painkillers will do you in. Three cases in point. Jay Bennett died broke as shit, painkillers. Michael Jackson died rich as shit, painkillers. Heath Ledger, rich as shit, painkillers. Yeah. Painkillers, you don't fuck around with those.
No, yeah, yeah.
So let's get some painkillers and continue this interview. So in college, you were just acting. When I say just acting, I don't mean like you had an easy job. I'm just saying you were just an actor. And now that you're in Chicago, you're not just acting. You are still acting.
Right.
But you're doing other things in theater.
Yeah.
What are you doing in the theater?
I had been minorly interested in directing when I was in college, and we had to take a directing class. And so I directed a one act while I was there. And it was a lot of fun. And so I had kind of wanted to keep doing that, and when I got to Chicago, I was like, well, I'll just stick with acting until it comes up that I can direct. And I was fortunate enough to very early on get hooked in with this theater company, of which I'm a part now, called Chicago dell'Arte. And it's a Commedia dell'Arte troupe, and we kind of put our own spin on it, a modern kind of spin to it. And one of my good friends, Ned Record, is the artistic director. And in speaking with him and working with him on multiple shows, it came up in conversation one day that I would like to try directing. And he's like, well, that's great. You know, you can work with me and we'll direct the next show. And so I was able to, this past season, direct a full length show with them. And, they had faith enough to let me direct more. So I'll be directing our fall show, which is going to be, a Commedia version of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, which will be interesting because Shakespeare isn't really my bag, but I'm brushing up as much as I can before I have to go into directing it. But
for that play you directed, did you just direct or were you also acting in it?
I was in it also. I had a small role in it, but it was small enough where I could still direct and things like that, but it was still fairly challenging because it's hard to be directing a scene while you're also in it, which is why we usually do kind of co-directing things. But I think for Much Ado, I'm lobbying to have a very, very minor background role or not a role at all, so I can just focus on the directing side of it because it's a little easier that way.
Do the actors you direct respect you more because they know you're an actor, or does it matter?
To me, I think it matters.
When you're an actor, you like a director that also acts.
Yeah, and I kind of have that in sort of everyday life and jobs as well. Like, I have way more respect for a manager at a job who's done my job as well.
Okay.
So they know kind of where things go. And the same with directing. Like, if I know that there is a director who has also acted or has worked in that side of things as well, it helps for me to kind of understand where they're coming from also. Mm-hmm. Not to say that there's not directors out there who have never acted who aren't amazing,
yeah.
but it's just, it's usually a lot easier because they'll kind of, they understand kind of where your mind is from an acting standpoint as well as, you know, where they're trying to get us from a directing standpoint kind of thing. And I think it definitely helps me as a director having that acting background because it can help, you know, if I need someone to be in a certain kind of mindset, I can try to help explain it to them mm-hmm. through that kind of thing.
Well, you've been in a relatively supportive environment where you've been directing, though. Like, you're part of this company.
Right.
Do you get to cast the play as well?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Which is really nice.
Have you not casted or cast somebody because they believe in your acting styles as well? Or does that ever come up? Like, if you know someone's a method actor, will you cast them?
If they're good and it's not so obtrusive that it's going to mess up the rest of the show, then yeah, I totally will. But I know there's a lot of actors that I've worked with who, you know, may not necessarily be method, but they have a certain way of going about things that's really disruptive mm-hmm. to what else is going on, and it just breaks the flow. I'm a big believer in making sure that all the cast is comfortable at any point during the show, and if there's ever any kind of discomfort, it needs to be quashed as quickly as possible because it really kind of drags everything down. So, you know, if somebody's, you know, if they have to, you know, drink a bunch of coffee beforehand to get in character, they need to, you know, chain smoke for a while beforehand, that's cool, but don't let it cut into the time yeah. of what everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
You know?
You said that you had an interest in directing, but you never really said why.
I'm not sure. I don't know if it's the sort of OCD control freak side of me mm-hmm. or what, or if it's just like I enjoy kind of, even as acting, like getting something from sort of the base level and building it up and kind of seeing the finished product out of all of it. And I don't know. I think that there's a lot of directors that have kind of that are kind of unsung heroes when it comes to shows, and I think that I'm totally comfortable with that. I would rather, you know, oh, these actors are great and the show is great, that kind of thing, and they don't say anything about directing, but it's very well implied that, you know, that mm-hmm. you know, if these actors could, you know, they could be amazing actors, but if they have a really shitty director, it's not going to be very good at all.
Do you think that a lot of people know that, or only the people in theater know that, or only directors know that?
I think that people in theater know that. I feel like there's probably a good handful of people outside of, like, the theater realm that just kind of think, oh, you have a great group of actors, and they're mm-hmm. kind of what make it, and, you know, the director kind of sits back and goes, you move over here, yes, that's nice, and they kind of sit with their hands mm-hmm. crossed in front of them and everything else. But yeah, I think that when it comes to the theater world, I think people definitely will key in on, oh, this is a great show, who directed it,
mm-hmm.
You know, they must have had some kind of hand in it. And,
of course.
And with as small as the theater community as Chicago is, you know, there's a shit ton of actors and directors and designers in the city and companies, and but it's still really small and word gets around quick. So, you know, if a show is really great and the actors are amazing in it, but the director was really shitty, people will know that.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's you know, a show can be amazing and be great, but if the director was a real prick and everything, like, he didn't know what he was doing and the actors kind of directed it themselves, word will get around quick that happened. And
okay.
Recognition.
So you
will
can't
come.
Really make enemies with your actors.
No, I would highly, highly advise against that.
Okay.
Because Chicago's way too small of a theater community and arts community in general to have anyone be on your bad side.
Well, let's go back a little bit further. You aren't from here. You're from St. Louis. You alluded to that.
Yeah.
You decided to come here for theater. Why here over New York or L.A. or any other town?
Chicago, I've always kind of loved Chicago, just because being a Midwestern boy, Chicago still kind of has that Midwestern aesthetic mm-hmm. and the kind of friendly thing. And I've been to New York a couple of times when I was working out on the East Coast doing things. And it's a little too big and impersonal, and I feel like going straight from college to a Shark Tank like New York to do theater would have been completely swallowed whole, because it's just too much going on. And Chicago's great because it has these tiers of theater where you can just start out and do a lot of shows in small companies and still get the same recognition as you would if you were doing a show at Steppenwolf or the Goodman and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, people take notice of, you know, if you're in a small show performing in a small place, it'll word will get around that it's good. Like, there's a lot of shows that have started in, you know, small black box theaters in this town that have become big deals. And I feel like there's not that in New York at all. It's either you're performing in basements all the time or you're on Broadway or like just off Broadway. There's not a lot of give and take.
So what's the goal? Is it to end up at the Steppenwolf or the Goodman, or is it to end up in New York, or is it to be out of theater completely?
At this point in my life, my goal is to just be able to do theater full time, to not have to have a day job or anything else. And if that means, you know, I'm in New York doing things, or I'm in LA doing things, or I'm here in whatever is going to get me where I'm doing it full time, where I don't have to be serving tables or an office bitch somewhere, then I'm totally cool with that.
Why theater over film?
I like the sort of instant response of theater, and you know, the sort of cliche of like anything can happen in live theater, that kind of bullshit. I like that aspect of it, and I like being able to see the people's faces when I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I just did my first like actual film, a student film.
Did you act in it or did you direct it?
I acted in it.
Okay.
And it was a lot of fun, and it was a good experience. But it's definitely a whole different kind of side of acting that I'm not totally zeroed in on quite yet. And it was a lot of fun, and I had a blast doing it, and it turned out really well. But it's just, and I prefer that kind of live, instant response kind of thing, and being able to walk out after a show and have people immediately tell you, oh, this is great, this is excellent, and it's, you know, the finished product is there, you're done, you're off. Whereas with film, everything is kind of chopped up, you're not doing it all in succession, and then you have to wait a few months before it comes out, and then, you know, maybe people don't see it, and...
When you're acting alongside, obviously, another actor, or you're directing actors, could you tell when that person wants to be in film and this is a stepping stone? And could you tell when someone, like, is into the theater and is doing this for the love of it?
Yeah. I think I can tell, I think.
As a viewer, as a director, as an actor, how?
I think I can tell... I can tell if someone is acting on stage that has done a lot of film before, because it's a different kind of... With film, it's a lot more, you know, subtle movements and, you know, kind of a low voice kind of thing, whereas in theater, you know, everything is a little bit exaggerated and a little bit bigger. And if you're you know, I've seen shows where there are people in it who have obviously done a lot of film because their faces are all... You know, it's really subtle kind of eye movements and, you know, eyebrow raises and things like that, where, you know, it's fine and all when you're in a small theater and you can see that, but, you know, you want to have a little bit more. And I definitely, when I was doing the student film, the director told me multiple times, he's like, you're being a little too theater right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of cut it back a little, because, you know, you only have so much room to work in. You can't be too big or it's going to, you know, overtake the
Completely.
Camera too much. Yeah, so...
You're not just a, like, yes, you are an actor, yes, you're a director, but you also write.
Yeah.
Have you written any of the, have you written plays?
I wrote one or two in college that weren't really very good, and I just wrote them for, like,
class
assignments
yeah.
and shit like that.
Do you have any desire to do that?
Not really, because I'm not very good at it, and...
Why do you say that?
I'm not... Most of the stuff that, my sort of focus in... composition when I was in college in English was like creative nonfiction and stuff like that, and I can write dialogue and stuff like that. It really bothers me trying to write a play and it's like, okay, character A says this, character B does this, and it's like, I just want to write it all out in one big, you know, continuous story paragraph, not have to break it up. And I mean, I guess I could write a whole play like that and then go back and translate it back in.
You have no desire to do that right now?
Not really. No, I don't have the patience for it.
But you are writing now about music.
Yes.
Why? So music criticism. For a blog.
Yeah, I actually just got the job
there
today.
There you go. You could say it if you don't have
Oh, sorry. I just got a job today, as a matter of fact, working for a website called Consequence of Sound.
Okay.
It's consequenceofsound.net. And my first article should be up next week.
Why do you like doing this?
I've actually wanted to be a music critic for a long time, even when I was in high school. Creative writing kind of was something that I just sort of fell into. I needed the credit in high school, and so I took it when I was like a sophomore. And I loved it, and I've been writing ever since then. And in college, I focused more towards you know, in high school, I wrote a lot of really shitty teenage angst poetry. Mm-hmm. And then I hit college, and I did a lot more compositions and creative nonfiction stuff and all that crap. And here recently, I've been writing more poetry just because I haven't had this sort of creative outlet of, here, write about this, write a story on this.
So you feel like you need an assignment.
Oh, yeah. When it comes to... I have a few, like, kind of essay ideas in my head, but I'm never, like... I need some sort of deadline, and I'm not good at giving deadlines to myself, because then I'll just be like, I'm not writing this for anybody, so what the fuck, I'll just... why do I need to do that?
Okay.
but music criticism has been... because music is a huge part of my life when it comes to, like, listening, reading about, and, you know, I spend... being unemployed, I spend a lot of time on the internet reading, you know, bad music blogs and things like that.
Of course, of course. Have you been in a band?
I have. I was in a band in high school, and in college I was in a cover band, actually, that was a lot of fun.
How was the cover band? What'd you cover?
We were called the Dance Commanders, after the Electric Six song, Dance Commander.
Okay.
And we were awesome. We kind of just called them party songs. It was like everything from Party Hard by Andrew WK and The Darkness and Electric Six to 99 Problems by Jay-Z and Marvin Gaye and CCR and all that crap.
But you don't play now?
Not currently, I don't, know.
Do you miss it?
I miss it a lot, yeah.
Do you find it weird that you're currently in theater as an active participant and you don't do theater criticism, but you're not in music and you do music criticism? Or is it better that way?
I think if I was doing theater criticism now in Chicago, on Chicago theater, and also being involved in it, it would be... it could very easily be a nail in my coffin. I mean, I could write under a pseudonym and everything else, but I feel like with theater, I criticize it in my head and everything else. I don't really want to put it out there just for that small community thing, but also, I don't know. I feel like I need some sort of detachment from being involved in the world and criticizing it, I guess. I don't know. That seems like a really lazy answer, but
it makes sense. But let's say you started a band tomorrow and you started playing shows 6 months from now. Would you stop writing about music, or is it so big and you could write about it worldwide that it really wouldn't come up?
I think I could keep writing about it.
Okay. Do you miss playing?
Oh yeah, I miss it a lot. I've been trying to do a lot more kind of open mic nights and things like that here.
Really?
Recently.
How is that? That
I've
sounds
done,
awful.
It, yeah, we. My old roommate and I did one a few weeks ago, and I was nervous as all.
Where was
out.
It at?
Gallery Cabaret.
Okay. Gallery Cabaret, for those of you that don't know, it's actually a really nice bar. It's in Bucktown.
Yeah.
Great drink specials.
Yeah.
Some of the worst paintings you'll ever see on the walls.
Right.
It's a future of sadness, but surrounded by a very good people.
Right.
Very,
yeah.
Very large hipster population in that bar.
Yeah,
you would not
I was really
think
surprised
so.
By
That's
it.
Because there's $6 pitchers every night.
That's true, yeah.
So,
yeah.
How was that open mic?
Well, I didn't... going into it, my room was like, yeah, we'll go to Gallery Cabaret, it'll be great. And I was like, okay. I didn't realize it's kind of a big deal. Apparently their open mic night is very well
attended.
They
have a lot of vets.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot of old dudes there playing. Yeah. You know, some old dude got up there and played a lot of like Bob Dylan and shit like that, but there was a lot of people there, and I was like, "Well, you didn't tell me that there was going to be, you know."
Did you end up playing though?
We did.
Okay.
We got there and signed up immediately, and we were still like 14th in line, so we showed up at like 8 to play. And we didn't actually play probably until 11:30 or midnight.
Okay.
And by that point, I was, you know, 4 or 5 beers into the night just to kill the nerves, but it didn't really help all that much. And everything that we had practiced beforehand, you know, as usual, went to shit once we got up there. But
so what did you do? Did you sing? You play guitar? What did you do?
I sing and play guitar. And then my old roommate, she plays guitar and sings as well, so we kind of did.
So it was a she and him type duo.
Yeah, we played. We just
Nancy
did.
Sinatra, Lee Hazelwood type. Like, give me. Give
we
me something
we did.
Here.
We played 3 covers. We did "Sea of Love," the Cat Power version. We
very
did.
Good song. Her cover of that is great.
Yeah, yeah. And when my roommate first my old roommate first introduced me to that version, all I knew was the Tom Waits version, which came out on Orphans a few years ago.
Yeah.
Which is completely different.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we did the Cat Power version when we did a new song by, I'm going to butcher her name, Rachel Yamagata or something?
Yeah, the old Chicago artist. She used to sing for Poydonk Pondering back in the day.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
She's not good. Go ahead.
Well, she did this song called Duet with Ray LaMontagne.
Oh, okay. Who's great. Yeah, he's
yeah,
great.
And unfortunately, it's on the Twilight New Moon soundtrack.
Oh, she's going to get rich as shit.
Yeah,
off of that.
She totally is. And it's a good song, but whatever. So we did that, and then we did... and I don't want to like this song. I really fucking don't, because they're past their prime, and my roommates and I have had multiple drunk and just, like, angry conversations about Weezer and how they're just, like, shitting all over their own graves.
Now I got to back up from the mic, so I got to scream at you. Weezer, to me, has taken on this awesome place in history. Okay. This stems from a conversation I've been having with a few other people. I had with Merle on this podcast, but Local 101, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
There's this type of music, which is pseudo-emotional music. I used to call it date rape rock.
Yeah, I heard that last week.
But
yeah.
It's actually pseudo-emotional music. It's a more apt term.
Yeah.
And I fucking hate it. It's the worst thing ever.
It is.
But I like Motley Crue because it's not pseudo-emotional. It's just straight-up metal.
Right.
Trust me, this is going somewhere.
No, I gotcha.
So these guys are straight-up, and Weezer's trajectory is very fucking similar to this.
Right.
Weezer started out with this extremely emotional story type songs all about alienation and just being the left man out. And it worked really well, and that's why everyone loves Pinkerton.
Yeah.
But there's a reason why Pinkerton didn't sell that much. Let's be honest. There's no hooks on that record. I fucking love it, okay?
Yeah.
So, whatever. Fuck off.
no, it's a great fucking record.
It's a great record, but it's not nearly as hook friendly as that new single.
No, yeah, and that's the one we did. Was
this is the girl? If you want me to,
yeah. If you're wondering if I want you to, yeah.
Fucking rules.
It does.
There's no ifs, ands, or buts
it
about
does,
it.
Yeah.
Now a song like Beverly Hills, that song sucks.
No, yeah.
There's no hook in that song.
Which actually, funny side note, that song has the exact same chord structure as The Joker by Steve Miller Band, which was a song that we covered in my cover band in college.
There you go.
And the guy who was our lead guitarist.
Fuck Steve Miller.
Would play during like one of the jam sessions we would have in the middle of it. He would just start playing the Beverly Hills like the solo to that song, and then it, like, would step away from the mic and just start going Beverly Hills, and people were always really fucking confused.
Yeah,
and we did the same with Lust for Life is the same chord structure as Are You Gonna Be My Girl by Jet.
Yeah,
and so when we would play those, he would sing Lust for Life over the top of it.
Did you also do Since You've Been Gone?
No, but I really wish we could have.
And then people go, it's Maps!
Right.
But the only reason why I mention that is because that was like a year apart. And
right.
At least Jet was like, let's go from 30 years of heroin addiction.
Right.
Anyways.
Yeah, so Weezer, yeah.
Fuck, great band. I love them. I don't care what anybody says, and I don't think he cares at all, and that's ballsy as shit.
Yeah, that's the thing.
How are you going to maintain being in that level of spotlight if you're 40-something and you're still singing in the garage?
Yeah.
Well, you got to keep it consistent and say, fuck it, I'm going all out,
yeah.
And that's what he's doing.
Yeah, when I first time I saw Weezer was in high school. I was like a freshman.
And you saw Weezer Point 2. Like,
I saw them right after
Green Album. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Weezer 2.0.
And I was like all excited, fucking, yeah, Weezer's going to rock out. And I saw them, and they were boring as hell on stage.
Where'd you see them at?
I saw them in Columbia, Missouri, which is where University of Missouri
is. Did you see them on that tour with Tenacious D and Jimmy Eat World?
I did see them on that tour, but before that, they did the Yahoo Music Tour with Ozma and
Get
Up Kids.
That was pre-Green Album, actually.
Was it right before Green
Album?
It
was before the Green Album.
Okay, yeah. I saw him on that, and then I saw the Jimmy Eat World,
that was
Tenacious
D one. Yeah, yeah. So I saw that tour. He looked bored out of his fucking skull.
Yeah, yeah.
But now he does not look bored.
Because he just doesn't have to play guitar, and he just jumps
around.
He
still plays guitar.
On some songs.
Yeah, exactly.
But now fucking Patrick Wilson, the drummer, is
which
now
is
playing
great, because he never wanted to play drums.
That's true.
In their second video for Crazy, he's literally running around the drum set.
Right.
And Matt Walsh always wanted to be their fucking lead singer. Like, that's the way that
No,
there's a reason. Did you ever listen to Matt Walsh's solo stuff?
No, it was Matt Walsh or Matt Sharp.
Matt Sharp, sorry.
Yeah,
Matt Walsh is a comedian.
Yeah,
totally
Matt Sharp
different.
Was the bassist. And then did he do solo before he was in?
No, he did not. Then he went to the band. What's it called?
They did fucking Friends of Pete.
I always
the
say
Rentals.
Pretenders. Yes, The Rentals.
Yeah.
And then his solo stuff came out. Did you ever hear that?
Mm-mm.
No, that's awful.
Is it?
It's so bad. I saw him play at CMJ one year. In some place like not much bigger than my apartment, and everyone was like, oh, this is gonna be great. Oh my god, it was fucking boring.
Yeah, see, because my roommates and I have multiple conversations like, oh, if only Matt Sharp would have stayed, if only he would have stayed, but
it was for the best. It was definitely for the best.
They should have exploded like they did after Pinkerton. And
kind of, yeah. I mean, if think about it, like the Pixies. If the Pixies just kept plugging through, like, they would be exactly where Frank Black was in like 99, playing the Abbey Pub and like releasing some of the best music of his life.
Right.
But just completely overlooked.
Yeah.
I mean, Urge Overkill, if they waited 5 more years to reunite, they might be playing Coachella.
Yeah,
but
I can see that.
No, it's over. Like, they were reunited way too early because cocaine's an expensive drug.
Right.
But you're writing about music, and you have this background of it. You were also, we have this in common, you were a program director at your college radio station as well. Do you miss radio?
I miss it a whole hell of a lot,
Why?
I love it. When I was there, that was, my uncle used to do radio in St. Louis.
Oh, really?
And yeah, he did, I don't know if it was like a college station or if he was actually on a real station, but, he used to do radio and, like, I always thought it was just a fun, cool thing to do, and so one of the first things I did when I hit college was join the campus radio station, and I kind of did every job imaginable there. But, yeah, I miss it a lot, and I've been trying in this city to get a job on air somewhere.
Like, that's never going to happen.
No, it's never going to fucking happen, and it bothers me.
Do a podcast.
Yeah, I've considered. My roommate and I actually did one podcast. We were going to do walking tours of Chicago.
There's actually that's not a bad idea. It's been done technically by the city.
Well, no, what we were going to do, though, our version of it is just...
Not the typical tourist.
Yeah,
places.
It's just us, like, the first one we did was going to the Bean, and it was, like, us walking up to it there and being like, look at all these people around, and, like, interviewing people and asking them if they were going to put the pictures they were taking up on their MySpace and Facebook and stuff like that. So it'd be like, you hanging out with the two of us while we went to the Bean is basically what it is.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
I say go fucking go out.
We
don't
need
do
to.
The Bean.
Now that he doesn't have a job, we hang out all kinds of
do it, man.
Shit.
Do you want to, when you say radio, like, if you, that's more just general... like public radio type stuff. Do you want to do more music stuff? Or does it matter?
I don't think that it matters. I definitely had looked into doing like internships at NPR here and Chicago Public Radio and stuff like that, but I don't know. Like I mean, I'm kind of a rambler and just kind of talk about shit and I feel like I could do a music show and all that kind of stuff, but I don't know that I could do a radio show, a standard, like, oh, here's some songs, listen to them, blah, blah.
So
if it wasn't, like, a college station. Okay. Like, I can't...
So you don't want a program director is what you're saying.
No, like, I couldn't go work at, you know, fucking Q101 and just, like, with a straight face and, like, a good feeling in my soul. Like,
well, no one has a soul there. I will say that on
air. Like, I don't think I could do it. I'm like, oh, here's this sweet new jam from fucking Nickelback.
Stop saying, see, you're already saying fucking right
now. Here's this sweet Nickelback jam for you to groove to. Q101.
Yeah.
Like, I would have to go home and just drink every day.
You could drink on air back in the day. That's the only reason to do a podcast, because you could still drink on every podcast.
True. Yeah, that's true.
Even though we're drinking coffee.
we're not badass.
We're going to close this out because we both need cigarettes, because we're artist types.
Exactly.
I'm going to close with a question from the Kids Book of Questions by Gregory Stock, PhD. I was in Borders today looking for another question book, and I found that Gregory Stock has an adult question book, but I'm on the fence of getting it, because like, this is such a bad book. And I feel like the adult one might be better.
Right.
And I kind of want to only get it if it's worse. So.
Gotcha, okay.
Give me a number between 1 to 260.
137.
All right. If you could see into the future but not change it, would you want to do so?
See into the future but not change it? What's the point of seeing into the future if you can't do something?
You're not
about
thinking.
It now?
You're not thinking clearly, because there's a fucking clear answer.
No, I would not do it.
Really? Why not?
If I couldn't change it, then what the fuck is the point?
Okay.
Like, I mean, what's the point of?
It's kind of like Back to the Future, right?
Okay.
Two, which is actually just as good to me, because like, fuck you, Crispin Glover. You're in this movie whether you want to or not.
Exactly.
Who says you can't bet on shit?
That's true, I guess.
That's changing your present by knowing the future.
Okay.
That book's fucking retarded. Of course I want to go to the future. You know, I'm going to bet that people are going to lose money and AIDS is going to get bigger and people are going to have water shortages and blah, blah, blah. And then the Cubs win in this year. I'm fucking billionaire. The end.
That's true. You could drop a shit ton of money on the Cubs.
That's it.
For whenever they're going to win.
That's it.
And
that's
do anything.
All it is. Just the next four World Series, I'm done.
And then you get a sweet high-rise apartment with some futuristic ladies and a lot of, like...
I'm going to get the Svetka Vodka lady.
Yeah, and a lot of, like, pajamas that are leopard... Well, isn't that what Biff wore when he went to the future?
Oh, no. Biff was too busy in the past almost raping Michael J. Fox's mom.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I'm going to hire you 20 years later, almost rapist.
Almost rapist.
If my future son didn't come and stop you... What a great fucking film. And the scariest part of that film was definitely 2003, when the World Series almost, it kind of was the Marlins and the Cubs, because that was the NLCS.
Yeah, that's true.
And it
true.
Predicted the Florida team winning the World Series against, or the Cubs beating the Florida team in the World Series, which didn't exist. Like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
That was crazy.
That kind of stuff is, like, there's some book I saw on a website some dude found that was like, what it's going to be like in 2010. And then he, like, had saved it over the years and pulled it out and, like, put it online. Mm-hmm. And it was like, talking about you wake up in the morning and press a button and there's your teacher and she'll just teach you from your bedroom over video conferencing and blah blah. And I was like, oh man, the future.
Future's the exact same.
Future's now.
I'm already bored with my iPod.
Yeah, exactly.
I just love being in my brain. Spoiled 21st century white male.
Exactly.
It's the best. Okay, I'll predict that. 50 years from now, it's still going to be the best to be a white male. The end.
Done. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of white males, Daniel Knox just played The Hungry Brain on Monday. It was a. Have you seen Daniel Knox yet? Music writer?
No, I have not. But I heard a couple songs that you've put up on this, and it's
he's
pretty good.
So good. He's my favorite. So I'm going to play one of his tracks to close us out. Nick, where should people come and see you?
The next Chicago Del Arte show will be opening April 8th at the Right Brain Project, which is at Irving Park and Ravenswood. The show is called The Literati.
So it's on Irving Park and Ravenswood. It's right by the train tracks, like right off of the train.
Easy
transportation.
Those big warehouses that are right there, it's right in there.
It's a great neighborhood. Lots of good bars to drink at after the show.
Yeah,
go to the
sure.
Long Room.
Yeah.
What else? Like, where's the website?
The website... For the
Chicago Del Arte.
It's just chicagodelarte.com.
Great.
And it's got a bunch of information on there. This is going to be a pretty involved show, so it should be pretty awesome for us, I think.
So go impress those ladies and gentlemen about your artistic sensibilities by taking them to Storefront Theater in the city of Chicago.
That's
you
exactly
will
right.
have sex with someone.
You will.
Maybe.
Yeah. They may have more hair than you on their legs and armpits, but it might totally be worth it.
And if you definitely don't want to have sex, what's that music blog they could check out?
It is called Consequence of Sound.net
because .coms are boring.
Yeah, fuck them.
Consequenceofsound.net. Thank you, Nick. Let's listen to Daniel Knox. And this Monday at the Brain, there's I Ching Quartet and Blind Anabaptist Blues. That'll be a great, great show. Check out the Chicago Music Podcast for those bands. And have a wonderful evening.
I got kicked in the teeth.